They've got transsexual stuff.
Because Kathy Bogan is running down the downhill slope.
We just worked on that last session. I just hope it tracks what we did last session.
She's taken this home and spent 2 weekends already.
I believe it does.
Okay, well, I think you've given enough direction to the committee, and I hope you see we are still supportive and wanting to do this, and I want to thank you for all the changes you've made and the negotiating and working together with the counties. They're not in here objecting. I don't think there's anyone here from the counties that wants this.
They sent a letter to you. They were unable to be here tonight for a variety of reasons.
One of which probably being that they aren't up in arms about the billing.
That's right.
Yeah. That's the impression I have.
Okay, well, work with the people you indicated as quickly as possible.
Okay, well, thank you very much. How many people are here on 202? Okay, it's not quite as many as I thought.
I'll be right back.
Gene Wallace here. Okay, well, let's take Senate Bill 202. I think that'll be fairly quick. Council, the last time we were ready to go, or nearly ready to go on this, Arno Denneke had an amendment that he didn't have quite ready, and it's ready now. Is that this 615-83?
It's 615-83 plus. You all have a copy. I think you have a copy of a one-paragraph proposed amendment dated today from Gene Martin. So it incorporates part of this. Part of the LC amendment should be struck on page 2, and this language from this letter substituted.
Okay. The chair would move then that on.
On page 2 of the LC draft, what you want to do is delete lines 5 through 7 and substitute the amendment proposed by Mr. Maudlin.
Wait a minute.
Dated today.
Okay.
I mean, it starts with a 5 there. Is
that a document that we should have in our file?
Yeah, you should have a little page that looks like that.
He starts with 5.
And then what
is
we're amending
is
marking out a D.
It says proposed amendment by Gene Maudlin. It's a one pager, 5 lines.
He's got a D here.
He's putting it at
on his test. Is it attached to his testimony?
Well, it's in my file. It's just a single sheet.
Well, I see.
That's it, yeah.
Justice Denneke's concern was about exempting propane customers, and he had put in language last time that said that it would pipeline, the definition of pipeline doesn't include a system that distributes hazardous substances to fewer than 100 customers, which was far broader than what he needed to say to protect the propane gas customers. He has since worked with Mr. Maudlin and Jack Sokolowski at the Attorney General's office. And this language dated today is language that Mr. Sokolowski drew up, to which we think Justice Denneke has no objection. No one could get a hold of him today, and is basically what he told me over the phone yesterday, that they were going to limit it to 10 customers. All of the affected pipelines, I think only there are only 4 of these pipelines in the state that are propane gas pipelines serving fewer than 10 customers. According to the safety engineer at the Public Utility Commissioner's office. 3 of those are operated by utilities, and the other one is a private one.
So this is to exempt very small propane distributor, pipeline distributors?
Right. And I think the AG's language does it in a clearer way than the language that we had in the LC draft.
Okay, then the chair moves that we delete the language in LC draft dated 6/15/83 on page 2, lines 5 through 7, and substitute the Gene Maudlin amendments dated June 15/83, subsection It says subsection 5, but that's going to become D, a substitute D, I assume.
No, I think leaving it as subsection 5 is fine.
Then it'll be subsection 5, and the D will be taken out along with the rest of the language in the LC draft.
Am I asking if this has Denneke's approval?
Have you been able to find out, Mr. Modlin, if this has Mr. Denneke's approval? Please.
Gene Modlin, Deputy Public Utility Commissioner. Our counsel, Jack Sokolowski, talked to him on the phone the night before last, and he said it sounded all right to him. He was going to check with his client and get back to me, which I have not heard from him.
Okay. Well, I would suggest we act on the bill, and if we hear tomorrow that there's a screaming problem, we can always move the bill back into committee.
This is current federal standard as well, so it's not different.
Is there any further discussion on the chair's motion? You might as well wait there a minute. Further discussion? If not, is there objection to the insertion of the Gene Modlin amendment? If not, it's adopted. Now, this is the bill that, along with taking care of some concerns that the Public Utility Commissioner had, also has in it the idea that I had developed that's on lines 21 through 24. Within 90 days after taking office, the governor may remove the commissioner without cause. After the first 90 days of the governor's term, the commissioner may be removed only for cause following a public hearing and appeal. And at the last time we brought this up, one of the members said they wanted to do some research before they said how they felt about that, but it's my understanding, last time I talked with them, they didn't have a concern, but I wanted to bring that up. This is an idea that I've put in the bill. Give the Public Utility Commissioner some insulation from some additional security as long as they're acting within the scope of their duties.
What's the form for the public hearing?
The form or forum?
Forum. Public hearing on appeal, what does that refer to?
This is pretty common language used for gubernatorial appointments throughout the statutes. It doesn't specify. I went through a lot of agony looking at other states and trying to decide if we should say something specific about a hearing. And most of the statutes use this language and don't specify it. If you'd be more comfortable specifying it.
I'm just curious.
Well, what kind of a hearing do you think this would imply? Somebody asked for a hearing.
Something convened probably by someone neutral, open to the public with an announced time and a set of charges. And
yeah, so if you're talking about cause, you're talking about a due process hearing.
Yeah.
Where's the appeal?
Because all that entails in the public sector.
And where does the appeal go? And what's the appeal on the record or jury trial or what? Well, I guess if it's in the statute other places, we shouldn't worry about it here then.
Yeah, that's quite some precedent.
Okay. The chair would then move that we adopt the proposed amendments dated 6/15/83 S2 as amended by the heretofore inserted Modlin amendments. Is there discussion? It's my understanding that the Mr. Modlin takes no position either way on the removal from cause and hearing.
That's correct.
Your words were brought up to include this. I didn't quite hear that. You said S2.
I was just saying that it also includes the Modlin amendment we already mentioned.
Sure.
Okay. Is there further discussion of the amendment? If not, is there objection? If not, it's adopted, and then the chair would move Senate Bill 202 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Please call the roll.
Brown.
Aye.
Fry.
Aye.
Gardner.
Simpson. Aye.
Wires.
Aye. Motion carried. I asked who was here on this bill, and you raised your hand, Mr. Wilhelms. I assume you didn't want to say anything, or you would have let us know. Thank you. I hope you'll support the bill.
So 10:30. Relating up.
For the record,
this 135 was the net, the health benefits that we already took care of. $297. Have we done that yet?
Well, this $297 seems only fair after what we did with 42. This we're letting them be covered for indemnify for punitive damages for state the people or state officials.
We asked council at the last meeting, or it was discussed at least, and I asked council to prepare amendments that would place this into the current Tort Claims Act. Right, the amendments are here in our file, I guess. Is that the draft dated 6/14/83?
Before I forget, this bill has a subsequent Ways and Means referral.
Oh, boy.
And I forgot the subsequent referral. 202 had a subsequent referral. B&E.
Do you want to move to rescind the referral from 202?
At this time of year?
Yeah, the chair would move that he be authorized to write a letter to the President of the Senate asking the referral be removed from Senate Bill 202 and to contact Senator Kitzhaber to seek his approval before I send
what number?
The one we just sent out. Oh. It has a subsequent referral to E&E. Is there any discussion of that motion? Is there objection? Okay, that's adopted. I'll report back to you how that came out. Now, Senate Bill 297 has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So.
Do you want to remove the attorney's fees provision on it now, or before
we start? Well, I talked to this proponent of the bill who thought that maybe that referral might be removed, too. I don't know what would happen about that. I guess the first question is, do we want to send this bill out?
I'd like to send it out.
There are four of us here, so if anyone is reluctant, yeah. We should go on something else. But
yeah.
I'm comfortable with it.
I'm comfortable.
We could go through these amendments. We haven't done that yet.
I sponsored legislation like this back in 1975. It was called the Ralph Bunche Law. So I'm very comfortable.
Why did it have a referral to Ways and Means? I have a feeling if it goes there, it won't come out again.
The fiscal impact statement that I just got today says the number of suits may be substantial, increased costs to state and local government, circuit court caseloads, but it's indeterminate.
But I thought the testimony was that these people are already being sued, it's just in federal court.
Mm-hmm. We had testimony that it costs more to pursue these things in federal court. Takes longer.
So in other words, it's not really a question of whether they're going to be sued, it's which court they're going to be sued in. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I know we had an earlier concern expressed by the circuit court judges. Does that still exist, I wonder? Yes, Judge Bonebrake.
I'm Al Bonebrake. Representing the Legislative Committee of the Judicial Conference, our concern was not so much with the bill, but only in seeing that if it passed in its original form, that there'd be at least some statement of intent, which the proponents at least made, that the recognized doctrines of immunity, judicial immunity being one, were not intended to be abolished. There has been a substantial amount of litigation under the federal statute, as you know, on the question of various immunities, judicial immunity being one of them. It has been established through that litigation that the doctrine of judicial immunity was not intended to be abolished by
that statute. And our hope was that, at least there would be that statement of intent by the legislature, or possibly even some amendment to the original bill to state that recognized doctrines of immunity were not intended to be abolished. That was our concern.
Do you think not that concern's merits. Been dealt with in the amendments?
No.
That hasn't been?
I have. You're referring to the legislative council draft SB 297-1. I just got that today, and I still have some concerns about that.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Senator
Henderson. it seems like we went through this last time on the bill, but it's been a lot of bills in between. Are those on the federal? Is that immunity a common law doctrine, or is that in the federal law? Is that created by statute?
It's common law, Senator Henderson. It's a common law doctrine established by case law.
So I assume that would arise again, particularly since judges have the last word on it anyway. So
well. It may or may not. Frankly, it's likely that the doctrine would still exist, but it might well take a number of cases and substantial litigation to establish that. There would be a question if the bill passed in its form, and I assume that the first judge or two that were sued under the bill in the defense of it, the doctrine would be raised and would have litigation to establish whether or not it still existed.
Well, I guess my only other question is there's a lot of other than common law, probably immunity. If we mention one and we don't mention another, would that seem to imply that there was only one? I think we could make some legislative statement about the judicial
that any,
immunity. I mean, for the that, record and not
I
start
agree.
Putting it in the statute, I think
that may well be just a simple statement of intent that any recognized common law doctrine of immunity that we have, there are prosecutorial doctrines of prosecutorial immunity, legislative
what
immunity.
What amendment tradition. Can we make?
I don't know. I tried to think of drafting something that would bootstrap in the common law, and I don't know that that's possible. My suggestion was that possibly legislative counsel could do that. At least a statement by the committee that your intent was not to abolish any recognized common law doctrine or case law doctrine of immunity, I think. But at least that would be helpful.
I would rather do that, because if we put something in the statute, then someone will make the argument that we abolished everything but that.
That's right. So. I understand that argument. Thank you.
The rule of interpretation is you don't repeal common law provisions, immunities, unless it's clearly indicated you intend to do so. But this is sufficiently ambiguous. I think you should shore it up with a statement.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Fry,
does the amendment now, or the language on page 3, would that be an exception to the rule prohibiting collection of punitive damages against the state?
Where are you looking on?
Page 3 of the proposed amendments, line 22.
No award for damages. Any such claim shall include punitive damages, except
no,
an appropriate case
amendment.
Under 1983. Now, that's there's a sheet in here to compare litigation issues and comparisons, and this would show the parallelism that this would create with the federal relief, where there's now a punitive damages under 1983 actions in federal law would allow them in state court. One of the disincentives.
Well, that's a fairly substantial change, then, isn't it? We don't allow punitive damages. The Tort Claims Act does not now allow punitive damages, but this bill would.
Right? Under the
yes.
1983 situation, you see, the whole idea of this bill is to get these claims into state court. And one of the big things that keeps them in federal court now is that you can't get punitive damages.
Well,
under 1983 actions in state court.
Has that ever been tested, though? Because the state cannot limit
the remedies under 1983, I know they purport to define tort to include 1983 for purposes of the Tort Claim Act, but I don't believe that's ever been tested in terms of whether they can do that.
As a matter of fact, Mr. Chairman, I believe that there are cases that hold that punitive damages can be recovered on a 1983 action regardless of what the state's policy is.
I think, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, that's right. In federal court.
In federal court. Well, I don't think the state can restrict its remedy, its forum in that kind of way, though,
I don't think so.
For a federal cause of action.
That goes with
Skip Durham.
Builders. Chairman Myers and members of the committee, I'm Robert Durham in support of this bill. You are correct in regard to the litigation of a federal claim, a 1983 claim.
Right.
We're now talking about the litigation of state law claims. And in that respect, there is a prohibition on the award of punitive damages.
Yes, yeah, state can do anything it wants to with its state law claim.
That's correct.
And this bill would remove that prohibition as to public bodies?
As to officials. Officials that have engaged in conduct which has traditionally resulted in the award of a punitive
that damage. Is now not subject to punitive damages under the Tort Claims Act.
Now there is an absolute prohibition on the award of punitive damages.
By virtue of the Tort Claims Act.
That's correct. This lifts this narrowly only with regard to public officials who commit actions that traditionally has resulted in the award of punitive damages.
There's a question about how narrow that is.
Well,
somebody might call that narrow. I'm not sure I would.
Well, I've had difficulty myself, except in the case of real white collar crime, in cases that I brought, of getting punitive damages against a public official, because they have such an effective claim that I was relying on the advice of my attorney, or I was operating on the basis of what seemed to be a confused at worst set of state laws.
Well, just a minute. I didn't quite follow that, Skip. You had trouble getting punitive damages in white-collar crime?
Except in the cases of the most egregious sorts of official misconduct, literal, specific violation of the rights of public employees, for example. The punitive damages aspect of this is one of what I'd call the four real key elements of this, because punitive damages is about the only effective relief you're going to get. These are very small damage cases, by and large. Injunctive relief, declaratory relief, and the opportunity to recover punitives against the guilty official is really what this is about.
Senator Gardner.
Kathy Bogan gave me some copies of those cases that yes, you were alluding to last time, where you said that a 1983 claim in state court would be met with the challenge that you have to exhaust your state constitutional
claims.
None of those cases involved 1983 claims, did they?
The ones that I should answer that because I gave you the cases.
Yeah.
The cases that I gave you did not, and I think the case that Mr. Durham referred to this afternoon, to me, Seuss Builders, is a case which I did not give you,
mm-hmm.
is a case that said the 1983 action is not ripe until you've exhausted your Article 1, Section 18 claim.
That's a different question, though.
Yeah.
That's a different question. Because that may be an exhaustion requirement rather than a preclusion effect.
It's stated by the court in these terms.
I haven't seen that case.
The federal claim doesn't even exist because there is no state action if the Oregon state law gives you the protection of the right that you claim has been violated under the federal constitution. This is a doctrine which, according to a law professor at Willamette University, has been announced 11 times by the Oregon Supreme Court. I extracted exact wording out of three or four of the most recent decisions. Seuss Builders is one.
Were those 1983 cases?
Seuss Builders is specific.
No, how about the others? Were they 1983 cases?
Yes. Sterling versus Cup was an action under both state and federal constitutional cruel and unusual punishment or undue rigor. Provisions
I haven't read those cases, and I'd like to the 1983 cases, not the universe of other state constitutional cases.
One of the most important things to recognize is that the claimant will not get active litigation of a state law claim because you won't go to state court in the first place. because of the impediments that have been built in, and I've tried to show that in my form. You just won't get to state court in the first case, in the first place, because of the impediments of going there. I'm merely attempting to create as simple a forum to go to state court as it now appears to be to go to federal court. You have a number of impediments that have been drafted in the law, in my view, unnecessarily to protect conduct and drafted standards that give undue protection to conduct that shouldn't get that sort of a protection. And the purpose of this bill is to make it just as difficult or easy to go to federal court as to go to state court, so people in Kay Falls or Pendleton can go to their local court and be treated exactly the same as they would if they had to go to Portland and file a federal court lawsuit.
But not just for 1983 actions.
No, for two reasons. Number one, you may not have a federal violation, and therefore the emphasis comes very clearly. You must litigate state law claims. You must get active litigation of state law claims. And number two, once you do that, you will be faced, unless this bill is passed, with hurdles on punitive damages, attorney's fees awards, entity liability, and no qualified immunity. It's absolute immunity for public officials. That's the real guts of the bill, those four items. So you have to get involved in active litigation of the state law claim under the same standards as you would in federal constitutional litigation. You may not even get to the federal law claim because state law may give you the protection you need. That's the reason that this bill is necessary.
I have one other technical question here, Mr. Chairman. On your amendments dash one, page 3, you have in section 7. Are these your amendments, Skip?
Yes.
Okay. In any action under 42 U.S.C. 1983, or in any action to redress or deprivation of your rights, etc., the officers, employees, and agency of a public body shall be immune from liability for damages insofar as their conduct does not violate clearly established statutory or constitutional rights which a reasonable person would have known. Do you think you can engraft that kind of a limitation on 42 U.S.C. 1983?
There already. That's an exact statement of the existing qualified immunity under Harlow versus.
Okay. So you're simply reflecting the case law there. You're not attempting to limit the reach of 1983 at all.
Not at all. That's precisely okay. The existing federal law, and we would simply adopt the same for the state constitutional litigant with no changes in doctrines, tests, or the like. It's the same treatment you'd get in federal court. If I may point out something, I think Senator Fry raised a question about the punitive damages clause on page 3 near the bottom, line 22. Appropriate action means an action against the official, not the public body, and I wanted to make it clear that the intention was not to expose the public body to punitive damages. Again, this is perfectly consistent with existing federal law. We're not trying to make it easier to get more damages under easier standards.
You must have missed the other bill.
I had some comments about that, but so the intention of the phrase appropriate action means the action against the public official, not the public body. There isn't any exposure to public bodies to punitive damages under any of this bill.
Is there a motion? Thank you very much. Is there a motion on the Legislative Council amendments? Senator Hendrickson, do you want to move these amendments?
I'll move them.
Senator Hendrickson moves the Legislative Council amendments to Senate Bill 297, dated 6/14/83. I think I should state I think I have a potential conflict on this because the proponent of the bill is a partner in a law firm that I have some business dealings with.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to vote for this bill or these amendments at this time. I'm still open to the concept. I'm just not satisfied in my own mind that this is a good idea.
Okay.
Well, that's pretty much my feeling, too. I mean, we've got a real public policy decision to make on whether we're going to subject public officials to punitive damages, and then we've got to decide whether those are going to be reimbursed or whether, in fact, is the state going to end up paying the bill or not?
If Senate Bill 42 becomes the law, we've decided that.
Yeah.
Under current law, they don't.
And that's right.
So we could go back and have that discussion again. I guess the only thing we'd add to it is that the law isn't settled at the moment because we don't know whether 42 will pass the Senate and the House. I would say it's got about a 95% probability, but that ain't a certainty. I think we can be pretty sure it won't be vetoed.
Yeah, I think you can say that.
Seems to me that this bill fits hand in glove with the 42. And although I know that I'm sure by her presence here that the state court administrator sees it might have some cost, therefore she must resist, which is her job, it would shift a burden onto the state courts, but I think I've been convinced it would save money even for unsuccessful defendants, their agencies, because it would be cheaper done in state court rather than filing these things out in federal court. Suppose I've got a potential conflict under the substantial benefit theory, and somehow, I don't know how it would cut, but I have filed a case in federal court under the 1983 action.
Provisions that are substantively in the way, apparently.
Mr. Chair, I think that the reason we're repealing it is part of the unconstitutional scheme, because the way I read it is the reason they had that in there was to pick up people that were performing abortions, which were illegal under the law. They'd come into an emergency room, someone having induced the abortion, and that, I think that was a common way to get around the restrictive abortion laws in those days. And so this was a way to try to pick up on them.
It's and the emergency exception from the operation of the statute. So if the statute can't operate constitutionally, you don't need an emergency exception.
If I may add, this is also applicable to the situation where a woman comes in unconscious and maybe from a car accident, and the physician determines that he thinks she ought to have an abortion, and there's no one there to give consent and it's an emergency thing. At least there's some protection to her that certain standards were met or certain reports were made. This is a very grave decision for her and for her family.
Well, wouldn't that be handled under any kind of emergency room treatment? Where, I mean, they could be making all kinds of decisions about you while you're unconscious, you know, whether to cut off your leg or...
That's true. This happens to be, I think most people understand, it's a very serious matter for many families.
I know it's serious, but I'm saying they do all kinds of serious things in emergency rooms, and I think they have to have, they have procedures for your consent, or getting someone next to kin or someone to give consent in those kinds of situations. I think without having the statute, but I think the reason is it just won't, it falls of its own weight because it was part of the police power regulation of abortion, which was declared unconstitutional.
Well, let me just mention one last provision, if I may. ORS 677.190, that's the last provision that's being repealed at the end of line 2. Now, apparently, that takes away three grounds for the suspension of a license. Currently, a physician can have his license suspended if he aids a woman in a self-abortion, if he fails to get the written consent of a woman before abortion, or if he fails to get the consent of the parents or guardians under those limited circumstances where it's constitutionally required or permissible. Now, the question is, why is 677.190 being amended if it basically currently gives some licensure control over physicians who engage in what we deem to be illegal practices? I don't understand why we're repealing that.
Senator Gardner.
I don't think those are not failure to get written consent or failure to get consent of parents or guardians.
Now, if you there the Supreme Court has spoken to the point that you generally can't require consent, but there are limited conditions, for example, where the person to have the abortion is incompetent.
Right.
So
I'd be happy to respond to that.
Yes.
677.190 is being amended. The language they're taking out is at the top of page 2 of the bill. Okay. It's basically remove the ability to suspend a physician for being convicted under 435.455. That's one of the statutes declared unconstitutional in Benson. Okay. The other grounds for suspension would be failure to comply with the provisions of 435.415. That's another statute declared unconstitutional in Benson. Or 435.425, which was also declared unconstitutional in that case. So you would have a suspension based on three statutes that have been declared specifically unconstitutional.
Okay, let's go back. That is, you're correct. That is a provision being amended, not repealed. So I stand corrected there. And hit me once more, please. On top of page 3, section 5, remaining out, as I see it, just 435. Okay.
That's going to be, if you look at the amendments, that language is, I think.
The amendments?
On page 3 of the bill, the language referring to 435 will be
restored.
Restored, I think.
In part. Yeah. Okay.
No, wait a second. On page 3.
Actually, I sort of like to change that to reflect that recent decision where it cuts both ways. You also can't deny people benefits because they want to terminate.
Well, we're restoring 435 in an amended form, and yet we're deleting it on line 6 of page 3. Is that correct?
Right. That deletion, I was wrong. That deletion is not affected by these amendments.
Yes. So
because it was not meant, I don't think it was meant to refer to sub 3. I think it was meant to refer to the consent provisions of 435, which were declared unconstitutional.
Okay, so the point is the bill in good shape now with 435 having been amended and yet 435 being deleted on page 3 of line 6?
I would think, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gardner.
Though there may need to be some renumbering, which I think legislative council could do there, but I guess you are just amending 435.435, not repealing it, right?
Right, that's what the amendments do. I think the reference to that statute.
Yeah, and there it is, and that's just exactly what the amendments do because
right.
They've deleted the repealer. It is in good shape to do just that.
Where's the repealer?
They've taken out the repealer
online.
I
thought they did, and then I couldn't find it.
It's on. It's on the first five lines.
Okay,
of the
page 4 of.
They're deleting any reference to 109.660 at all.
Okay, I see it on. It's on page. It's line 4 of our amendments.
Right.
Okay, fine.
Please call a roll on the amendment, the motion to amend.
Brown.
Aye.
Fry.
Aye.
Gardner.
Aye.
Henderson.
All right. Motion carried.
I'd like to move the bill to the floor if you can.
Senate Bill 397 has been moved to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
I just want to say briefly, Mr. Chair, if I could. I think that we've worked over this bill very carefully, and I think that we've got some helpful suggestions from Ms. Radich as well as from Ms. Rice Coalition. And, I think, you know, we've done some very careful work on it, and I feel comfortable that we have tailored this fairly precisely and preserve some of the things that protect people from arbitrary coercion in terms of some of the issues that we've raised.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brown.
My vote against this on the floor 2 years ago, sending it back to committee, was because I was not persuaded the bill was in good shape. I was not persuaded that the bill at this time was introduced in good shape. The fact that we've had to have the amendments that are before you kind of indicates that. I hope it's in good shape now. I don't have that confidence. This is an extremely difficult area. And I think that we're just, as we did last time, just rushing it through. It not only contains obviously matters that have been deemed unconstitutional, but it makes, other than technical changes, it makes some real policy changes, and I don't concur in those policy changes.
what's the rush? Today's June 15th.
It's not even August yet.
Do you think this bill would be better around Christmas?
Try New Year's. That's a
I don't see any Brown amendments here.
No.
I hear opposition to the bill. That's, you know, that's everybody's right.
Sure.
I take a little exception to the allegation of rush, particularly when you don't have any amendments to offer. Please call the roll.
Brown.
No.
Frye.
Aye.
Gardner.
Aye.
Hendrickson.
Aye.
Wyers.
Aye. Motion carried.
Two to go.
Two to go.
Witnesses here on both of these other bills?
Yes.
Under 5 hours and 15 minutes, I'm getting stiff. Mm. You're ready for motion. Oh, no, I didn't mean that.
Which bill were you looking at?
I don't know. I kind of like that one.
Which one is that?
414.
You like it?
I think so. I don't know.
There's a lollapalooza of a fiscal analysis here, but there seems to have been some swelling since the hearing. The hearing was going to have four more patients. In the fiscal analysis, it's got 12 more patients.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frye.
If you're interested in finding out where people stand, I'm ready to make a motion on that bill.
1214?
Yeah. You want to rush it here now. Let's
what? I want to find out whether we need to rush it or not, so vote on this bill.
You recognize.
What's your motion going to be?
Motion table.
Okay.
Senator Frye moves to table Senate Bill 414. Please call the roll.
Brown.
No.
Frye.
Aye.
Gardner.
No.
Hendrickson.
No.
Wyers.
No. Motion failed.
But that's different than a motion to pass.
Yeah. This bill has got the mental health community pretty fired up. Concern about it. Seems to me that it should be doable, but the provision for the provision to have a guardian appointed doesn't seem to give them the feeling that they'll have the administrative flexibility they need. I said that I was particularly concerned about electroshock therapy and asked for more information about it. And the information we received does indicate that it is, as the mental health division testified, it is being used very sparingly these days.
Unlike the incidents where they use it on a potential vice president without any results.
Well, back when they used it on him, they were using it on an awful lot of people. But
he didn't know he was going to be a vice president.
Mr. Chairman, I've got.
Senator Frye.
If you're going to discuss the merits of this bill, I'm going to. I want to leave. I want to put a letter in the file. I neglected to get it duplicated before. I just discovered it in my file, but I recall it, and I think it sums up in just a few words why I would never vote for this bill. I won't vote for it tonight. I will not vote for it on the floor. If it comes out of this committee, I may even oppose it very vigorously. And so you're not going to need me anymore. But I'll give this to counsel.
Well, there is one more
bill. There's
another bill. I think.
not so fast.
So we get out of here. You post the bill and you leave.
You're not going to outvote no on the rest of the bill. Maybe a small boy that saw no.
A thousand times no, I would rather die than yes.
Okay, I'll get it.
Very, very original.
Well, that's a lot better than going to another committee, and then when that committee adjourns, going home. That's the one that really gripes me.
I must say, I've got a lot of letters from my constituents in opposition to this bill.
I am concerned that there's this kind of split within the mental health community, and it doesn't seem to break down exclusively into the doctors, providers on one side and the patient groups on the other. Not exclusively, but I'm encouraged that they are. The mental health divisions appears to be tightening up their administrative rules. This Marion Polk Legal Aid Service indicates that these final administrative rules regarding informed consent, which took effect March 26, 1983, Beal's administrative rule goes a long way toward correcting the deficiency of the present statute regarding a patient's right to refuse psychotropic medication and ECT, but not far enough. So some progress is being made. I don't know. I mean, that's a good sign.
It's a difficult issue because the drugs are very powerful and could be subject to abuse. And where do you strike the balance?
I guess I'm having a little bit of difficulty feeling that this body is not, and it's always a difficult one in some of these medical areas, is the competent one or the proper one to be setting the guidelines here, but maybe it is. I don't know. I just don't know.
This is the same kind of letter. There are a number of letters in your file from parents and relatives of people in the assault.
Right.
Most of them, this letter is an example, most of them think that under this bill, these people would be denied the drugs, which is not so.
It's consent.
It says.
It's all consent.
It says that they will have the medication if it's the least restrictive alternative to prevent severe imminent bodily harm.
I have a difficult time understanding how people in these institutions to start with have enough capacity to make an informed consent.
That's
one of the things that I'm trying to figure out.
Well, they're a lot more like we are than you'd care to understand.
We are a lot
I wonder
more
sometimes
like they are.
Yes. More formal than I am. At this point in the session, I believe I belong up the street here, and they belong sitting here.
Well, it is a little confusing if you work there. Well, the chair moves Senate Bill 414 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Just the way it is?
I don't see any proposed amendments here.
I thought there were some. So.
I don't have any in my book. No.
Okay.
Well, I got those are letters.
Is there discussion?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to vote for this motion either at this time. I still I'm interested in the topic, but I just, I don't know. I guess I'm just, based on that kind of response that we've gotten from both the provider community and the appearance of progress that appears to be made, I'm still not comfortable with that, with the bill. But I recognize the concept is a good one here.
Yeah, I would rather amend it to direct them to ensure that they have adequate rules or something. I just, and then keep them under the gun that way. I'm a little reluctant. I don't want to see it tabled, and I am interested in it too, but I'm not going to be able to.
Well, the two members who aren't here came in wanting to move to table it, so I'd kind of like to take final action on it. I'll withdraw my motion.
Wish there was something we could do that was...
There are three votes at least to table it.
Margie suggested, maybe, I don't know, something along that line is... But I don't know.
Requiring
quite
them
is.
To adopt rules and then bring some report back to us in terms of the.
They have a rule requirement anyway, right now.
No, they just adopted
Well, they
some
just
rules.
Adopt them, though, I think, about the time the legislation was in.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, I think that's one of the beneficial effects of the legislation.
Yeah, one of the things that's happened is that this bill has gotten a great deal of attention. I think we've all noticed that, haven't we?
Mm hmm.
Maybe that's accomplished about as much as is going to be accomplished realistically. We could let the bill sit in committee the rest of the session.
Well, I don't like to give them the message. That's why I didn't like to go up to table. I don't like to give them the message that we're not concerned or that we think there aren't problems that need to be addressed. I guess that's my concern.
And my sense is that drugs are, and my personal experience stems from some of the kids here in Salem, is that there are drugs are used more heavily in this state at institutions than they are in a lot of other places.
Why don't you direct the chair to send a letter to the Mental Health Division saying we're very concerned about this and we're going to have a continuing interest in it, and then table the bill.
And we'd like a report, maybe through, you know, periodic reports throughout the interim to this to the Interim Judiciary Committee.
You might not even have to write the letter because the ears are here listening to what you're saying. So,
I think the fact that this bill was seriously received has had a quite an effect.
I guess I would like a little bit more than that. If we could make that part of it, not a big part of the interim work, but just so they could report, say, at 3 month or 4 month intervals to this committee on the implementation of the rule or something like that.
Well, the Legislative Council Committee could do that too, because they have oversight over rules. We could.
Yeah, I would like to have a little bit more of a string on it.
Yeah, I'd like them to know that we're going to be looking at the interim, and if, you know, if we feel that the problem isn't addressed, there will be an interim committee. I guess
I like that idea that we could, that this would be one of the things that we would consider to look into as an interim subject.
Because I guess
we could have a mini study during the interim. That's one of the things that was done last year.
It wouldn't take long, but it would keep a little string on it.
Well, then, the chair, do you want to just direct me to write such a letter?
For the interim,
without a motion? I don't think a motion is needed.
Would it be appropriate, Mr. Chairman?
Well, I need to have a sense of the committee.
All right.
I would still move.
All right. Senator Hendrickson moves that the chair direct a letter to the Mental Health Division stating that we have decided not to take further action on this bill this session, but that doesn't mean there's a lack of interest, and we thank them for the information they provided, and they've certainly convinced me that they've got a real handle on not doing a lot of electroshock therapy, but that we're very concerned about the drugs, and we want to indicate a continuing interest, and that we'd like to have some more information from them so we could decide whether to have a mini task force during the interim.
I'd like to say that we are going to be looking at it during the interim.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I was concerned about is it's a very complicated area, and it is, maybe it's because it's a medical area. I really felt a little uncomfortable acting on it without having more study time involved in it, and it's difficult during the regular session to do that on a major.
Is there any objection to Senator Hendrickson's motion? If not, it's adopted. And now, chair moves to table Senate Bill 414. Please call the roll.
Brown.
Aye.
Cohen. Fry. Hamby. Dreiger.
Aye.
Hendrickson.
Aye.
Wyatt.
Aye. Motion carried. Now, 475. I don't know. It's 820.
Still going strong.
Still going strong? Well, you're my ride home. So I can't leave till you do. Council.
Okay. There are some proposed legislative council amendments. This is the self-help divorce bill that had one hearing. The major concern of the committee was the language on page 2 that would have used a 30-day waiting period for this procedure as opposed to the regular 90-day waiting procedure for dissolutions. The sponsors agreed to delete that language, and that amendment is reflected in the Legislative Council amendment. There's a technical amendment on the first page at line 6 to make it clear that the jurisdictional, this is, I think, the residency, adding ORS 107.075 to the jurisdictional requirements, and that's the residence requirement. That was something I had brought up. There's another technical amendment. Page 4 of the bill, line 9, had judgments being entered in favor of the counties. I think the state court administrator would not be real pleased with that. We're changing that to judgments in favor of the state. On page 4, on page 7, Judge Bonebrake brought to our attention that the affidavit for waiver of fees and costs, though it talked about income and expenses, didn't talk about assets. And so in case people had Mercedes, they wanted to know about it. So we've added in a section that includes assets on line 30. Judge Bonebreak also spoke with me at length about his concerns about the bill.
What's about the end of the blank?
Oh, the line 29 and 30 should read, my total monthly income from all sources is blank, period. I have blank as assets and blank as savings.
When they say my monthly expenses, if they have children, they're including your whole family, I think.
I think it means household expenses.
Because I know someone was saying in Lane County it's really bad because they segregate the custodial parents' expenses and then they don't let them prorate the family expenses.
You could add in the word household.
If that's a problem.
Household, where household
savings. My monthly household expenses? Is that what you...
Yeah, to make it clear, because if you've got two or three children... that you're including their expenses.
Are you on expenses now?
Are we on...
Line 30?
Yeah.
Okay, but between monthly and expenses for household?
Yeah. I don't know if you want to say household, because I have roommates, but I'm just considering the family expenses.
Family expenses? My monthly family expenses?
That's the concept. I don't know if that's the right kind of word to use. See, Anita? Huh? Well, this is one where you don't have children.
Right.
Sorry.
No. Okay.
There could be.
Well, this doesn't address the child attending school aspect. It's not a school. They may say it's impossible because of the marriage of only 10 years, but we frequently have people who have married more than once and may have been in the recent marriage of less than 10 years, but they have children. So it could be a school. I have a suggestion that just came to mind this evening.
Please come up, yes.
Just to sort of clean this up, I think that it also, where it says there are no minor children, there should be added language, nor children attending school. It could be over the age of 18, where someone would still owe a support obligation but be attending school, so that ought to be excluded too, I think. I don't think they have any problem with that. It's just an oversight probably in drafting.
Okay, so, but...
Do you have that language?
Well, but you're saying there still might be somebody that had a child from a previous marriage that they have to support. That would be important for their waiver of their fees. Wouldn't be with respect to the divorce itself.
Yeah, yeah, there could be children, yeah, even with this language. Okay, the question I was going to suggest it on line 7 where it says there are no minor children. That added in there would be also, not only are there no minor children, but no children qualifying as children attending school under the state.
Okay. I would do it this way. I would take out on line 7 the second there are, and I would add the language at line 8. So it says, there are no minor children of the parties born or adopted during the marriage, comma, no minor children born to or adopted by the parties prior to the marriage, comma, no children attending school, and the wife is not pregnant.
Line, can I do it, Judge Barnes?
Yeah, I'm satisfied. Line 14, I had a question about what the obligations are listed, whether that means a single obligation or aggregated obligations. The language in...
Okay, well, we move the amendment on line 7 and 8.
Could you read that, the last part of that on line 8, Kathy?
Sure. No children born to or adopted by the parties prior to the marriage, comma, no children attending school, comma, and the wife is not pregnant.
No children attending school. Don't you have to say no children
of the parties?
Or something like that? Because it might be other children.
Over 18 attending school?
No, it might be a child by a prior marriage or something.
That's do we want to deny someone who might want to get a cheap divorce just because they've got a child from a prior marriage?
Yeah, that would deny it in that circumstance. no minor.
I could see adding it in when you're trying to take into account their income.
Born. See, otherwise, if you have minor children, they have to be born or adopted during the marriage to disqualify. So minor children who are not adopted by a prior marriage would not disqualify. Right?
Right.
Minor children, prior marriage, not adopted.
Right.
No disqualification.
Right.
So...
Because there won't be any support obligation if they haven't been adopted.
But there is a situation that's not uncommon where people marry, two people marry, divorce, have children, divorce, and they then remarry again, and they could qualify for this because the most recent marriage of these same two people is less than 10 years. And this happens.
They marry each other again.
Yes. And so, and they may have children who are over 18 and attending school where there would be a support obligation. So then you have the question of whether or not you want to allow this procedure. That's the point I was trying to make. That sounds far-fetched, but that happens.
Wouldn't it be better, though, to say that there's no child of the parties, that there's a support obligation from one party to the other or something like that? Because I would...
Instead of pegging it as a minor.
Or no children under 18, I suppose.
Well, I just wouldn't want to... exclude, I mean, not have people who just happen to have children from other marriages not be able to use this service. Because they may not have any support.
Well, if we don't fine-tune this, we're going to let a few people through the sieve that we might exclude and leave.
What I'm pointing out is our observations that I had. That is, do you want to let people to use a simplified procedure if there are children that should be owed some support obligation? And the use of the word minor children would allow the situation where there are children over 18 and may still be attending school where there might be a support obligation if the father could be caught. This simplified procedure might be used.
Well, if we put it modifying on that first line, there are no minor children born to the party, or no minor children or children over 18 attending school born to the party, so that shows it's their children.
Right. Or adopted.
Like or adopted during the marriage.
Is the word dependent children, is that too broad because that...
Prior to the marriage.
Well, I think you have to show there's some legal obligation either because they're biological parents or adopted parents.
Yeah, if there are no minor children or children attending school of the parties born or adopted during the marriage.
Well, why don't we adopt that conceptually?
The language is...
It doesn't read right.